it 2 weeks in advance, too. cvb@wbai.org.
Listen up, sweetheart. If you board that plane without making a donation to WBAI, one of these days you'll regret it. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon, and for the rest of your life. WBAI is the only station with the guts and determination to seriously challenge this nightmare Trump. The rest of the media are cowards. It's the voice of the poor, oppressed, downtrodden, and the imprisoned. You know, Rick, this fella Trump is bad news. He's worse than Major Strasser. Act occasionally. Why don't you make a donation? I already did at give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org. Louis, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Hello and welcome to Health Action for March 15th, 2017. My name is Mark Hannay. I'm Director of Metro New York Healthcare for All and a member of the Health Action Collective that brings you this program every week. I want to say welcome to listeners. This is our new time slot here at midnight. Actually, I guess it's March 16th by now. So we're really glad to be here and looking forward to talking to you every week and bringing you the latest personal public health and healthcare news as we go. We always start each program with the news for the week, so here we go. The newspaper The Hill reports that House Republican leaders are coming under intense pressure to change their Affordable Care Act repeal and replace bill ahead of a possible floor vote next week on Thursday, March 23rd, the anniversary date of the signing of the law by President Obama in 2010. White House spokesman Sean Spicer said the administration is working with House leadership on a manager's amendment that would make changes to the legislation. Those changes, which Republican leadership offices declined to discuss, could be aimed at bringing more conservatives on board. Yet any changes to the bill could further alienate moderate members who are worried about lost coverage and price spikes for lower income and older people. Their fears were heightened by a Congressional Budget Office report released earlier this week that found that the Republican bill could result in 24 million people becoming uninsured over the next decade. At least 13 House Republicans are against the repeal plan in its current form, according to the Hill's whip list, with many more still undecided. Republican leaders have little margin for error, with 21 defections likely enough to stop the bill in its tracks. Adding to the troubles for congressional leadership, Senate Republicans are making clear that the legislation will have to be changed to pass their chamber. Critically, the changes they are proposing are the opposite of what conservatives in the House want. One of the proposed changes is an amendment that would increase financial assistance for low-income people under the bill. conservatives in the House say the tax credits under the bill are a new entitlement that must be scaled back, if not eliminated. President Trump and the White House appear to be giving leverage to conservatives seeking changes in the bill. Representative Mark Meadows, the chairman of the conservative House Freedom Caucus, has been in contact with top White House officials on a nearly daily basis, and he spent time this week meeting with key healthcare advocacy groups. An official at a conservative group said House leadership has moved from saying there would be no changes to the legislation to being more open to some negotiations. One change to the measure being sought by the conservative Republican Study Committee would move up the ending of the law's expansion of Medicaid to 2018 instead of 2020. However, House Republican leadership has pushed back on that change, warning it could jeopardize support from the moderates. House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy called this particular change very difficult to do. Conservatives also want the bill to repeal the Affordable Care Act's insurance regulations, which they say is necessary to bring down premium costs. But it's not clear that those changes would be allowed under Senate rules. Speaker Paul Ryan's office took a different tack than the White House on a possible manager's amendment, saying it's too early to discuss that. Speaker Ryan is under intense pressure to bring the health care bill over the finish line. If Ryan manages to get a bill through the House, it still is likely to face a steep climb in the Senate. Politico reports that at least 15 Republican governors have raised concerns about the House Republicans' health care bill amid the fiery debate surrounding the long-promised appeal of the Affordable Care Act, and no governors have expressed strong support for the American Health Care Act, as the new bill is known. Although these governors generally support repealing and replacing the current law, the Affordable Care Act, coverage losses predicted by the Congressional Budget Office have some withholding support from the bill. Others think the bill is not conservative enough, while some are unhappy that the bill does not give states more flexibility. Skepticism from these influential Republicans, whose states face real consequences if the bill is enacted, leaves House leaders in the White House without the support they desperately need to keep the embattled legislation on track. The bill would phase out the Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act that some Republican governors brought to their states. Although some other Republican governors rejected the Medicaid expansion, those who accepted it are worried that the bill will lead to drops in coverage in their state. NPR reports that the proposed American Health Care Act targets the health provider Planned Parenthood, with a set of proposed limits on Medicaid payments to the organization. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office confirmed the magnitude of those limits. The Republican plan would block $178 million in Medicaid reimbursements to Planned Parenthood in 2017, this year. In all, about 1.6 million patients receive health care from the organization each year through federal programs such as Medicaid, totaling upwards of $400 million in annual federal reimbursements. The Republican plan technically cuts off funding to Planned Parenthood for only 1 year. If the organization stops providing abortions altogether during that time, it would be eligible for Medicaid reimbursements again starting next year. But there's no chance that that will happen. Federal spending on abortions is already illegal, except in the case of pregnancies that are the result of rape or incest or that threaten the life of the mother. Republican lawmakers and some clinicians have said that if Planned Parenthood closes clinics, other health care providers would try to take on those patients. But community health clinics say they are already overburdened. The new Republican bill also calls for tens of billions of dollars for states to spend as they see fit, including on preventive care for women. And that's the Health Action News for this week. We'll be back with our major interview segment for this week's program. We're going to be talking to Sylvia Tara, the author of The Secret Life of Fat. It was part of something we featured on a fundraising special last month, and we're going to bring you the full interview in this week's program. Stay tuned. And welcome back to Health Action. We're going to start now with our interview with Sylvia Tara, who is the author of The Secret Life of Fat. And welcome to a Health Action special. We're taking a look at the new book, The Secret Life of Fat, The Science Behind the Body's Least Understood Organ and What It Means for You. We're speaking with its author, Sylvia Tara, Ph.D. She holds a Ph.D. in biochemistry from the University of California at San Diego and an MBA from the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. She's been a consultant with McKinsey & Company and has worked with some of the world's largest biotechnology firms. Welcome to Health Action, Sylvia.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here.
So I was reading your book. I found it fascinating. It sort of had a whole new approach to thinking about fat. And I think it's really contained in the title, The Secret Life of Fat. One term being secret, the other is life. So let's, in a general way, before we get into details, kind of pick that apart. Is this really secret? What's so secret about it?
Well, I think what's secret is all the amazing things fat does in our bodies that we have no idea about. So we always think of fat as just a storage bag of calories, and we have to get rid of it. It's excess, it's no good, and it's making us unhealthy. But in truth, fat is very dynamic. It's an endocrine organ. It is releasing hormones into our body that our body vastly depends on. And I give case studies of people who don't have fat or they have defective fat. And you can see how important your fat actually is once it goes awry. And so don't think of fat just as excess, just as blubber. It's actually very sophisticated. It has all kinds of tricks to fight for its survival. It is actually communicating with your brain. It is talking to your brain. It can control thoughts. It can control bone health, our reproductive system, even our immune system. It has a number of effects through its signaling mechanisms that you probably have never thought about.
And so then the second thing would be the term life. It's described as an organ. You've spoken a little bit about how the traditional view of it's just sort of blubber hanging around is not accurate. Anything more you want to add to that in terms of its life, as it were?
Oh, well, it's life. So it has different functions at different stages in our lives. So, you know, fat has different real purposes. When we're a baby, there's a lot of brown fat, keeps us warm. Actually, as we go through puberty, fat's critical. Our bodies produce it at amazing amounts, especially for women. It has a role in reproduction. It has a role in lactation and nursing babies. And then as we get older, fat has a whole different kind of purpose for us. It actually helps us decrease our risk of mortality from disease. It has protective effects as we get older, too. So, you know, the life of fat, what it does, what it's really doing at any stage of our lives changes, and it evolves with us. And so it has a kind of secret, life going on in there, a lot of things it's doing that it's actually really important to know if you want to manage your fat.
Your book starts out in the first introductory chapter talking about the changing view of fat, sort of how we've looked at it historically and culturally. What can we learn about that?
Yeah, so, you know, one is that our culture we have, it actually affects how we think of fat. So fat was not always hated. In fact, there was a time where fat was loved. So right after the Civil War in America, you know, there was poverty and destruction, and fat was hard to come by. There wasn't a lot of food. And in that time, fat was cherished. It was loved. And there was even clubs where, you know, they called the Fat Men Club. People had to be fat enough to join. It was a status symbol. The celebrities who were heavy were idolized. Women would pad themselves to look like some of the female celebrities. So it was loved throughout. And that started changing around the turn of the century, going into the 1900s, as the country came out of the Civil War, the industrialization took place, and people started doing better. They started eating. They had more access to food. They started gaining weight. And when that happened, it just summoned a bunch of warnings from leaders. There was military leaders who thought it wasn't strong to be fat. They wanted really strong, thin bodies for the military. It was patriotic to be thin. Religious leaders said it wasn't pious to be fat. And business leaders, too, for their factories, they wanted agile, able bodies. And so there became this echo chamber warning against fat. And in this time, fat stopped becoming just fat. It was now a judgment. this is when fat, disdainful comments about it came into being. Things like slob, fatso, you know, fatty, things that weren't really said before. And so it became a judgment on people if you had too much. And people naturally got very self-conscious about this. They started dieting. And this is really where the business of dieting took off. A lot of people took advantage of it. A lot of entrepreneurs and hucksters sold very questionable devices to a fat-fearing public. Tapeworms were sold to try to siphon off energy so you wouldn't gain weight. People would actually swallow tapeworm eggs. You know, fat-off soap that was supposed to dissolve the fat under your skin was sold. And it's now to a point where we actually spend about $60 billion a year trying to fight our fat. And shockingly, that's more than Homeland Security spends trying to fight terror. And so we certainly hate our fat more than ever. We spend more fighting it more than ever, and yet our fatness is higher than it's ever been as well. So clearly we're using the wrong tool to try to fight our fat. And if we want to do this effectively, we have to really understand what fat is. Go back, you know, to the beginning, before all the prejudice came in. What is fat? How is it working? Why does nature think it's so important? And then how do you really manage it if you want to? But we have to do it much more intelligently than we have been.
What was the impetus? You're a researcher by background and training. What was the impetus for you to get into this whole topic?
Yeah, so for me, I gained weight very, very easily, and I always did, even as a child. And I would watch people just eat whatever they want, eat indiscriminately, and not gain any weight. And I couldn't do that, and I couldn't understand why. And as I got older, you know, it just became harder, so I gained weight even easier. Certainly, as you get a career, you get more stressed, you gain weight. After having children, I gained weight. And I worked with personal trainers. I went on a number of diets. But I never lost as much as other people lost on a diet. And sometimes on certain diets, I could even gain weight. And it was really perplexing to me. And I think I just got really fed up with this. I was about to go on yet another diet. And I said, no, I am not even starting another diet until I understand everything there is to know about fat. And, you know, I'm a scientist by training. I'm a biochemist. So if someone can understand fat, I certainly can. And I decided to just devote an awful lot of time. And I think I spent 5 years just pulling out every paper out of the scientific literature. I think I read 1,000 papers in all, interviewed probably 50 leading researchers across the globe on the cutting-edge research on fat. And what I was finding out was just so surprising. It was so enlightening. I thought, I'm going to capture this in a book. I'm going to share this with people. And The Secret Life of Fat is that book.
Great. Your book is full of personal stories. It's not a dry textbook at all, both about individual patients, but also who had issues around weight and obesity and body fat and so forth. But also, I guess perhaps reflecting a bit of your own background, the stories of the researchers who kind of uncovered all these new aspects of fat that no one had really thought about or looked into too much. In some cases, it was almost a bit of a page turner for me. I wanted to kind of see how things sort of turned out. One of your first early chapters in the books talks about fat can talk. How does fat talk?
Yeah, so this is a great story. And you're right. I tell the whole, all of the science, I try to tell through stories because I didn't want this to be like a textbook. And so it's all of the learning is told through the stories of researchers and doctors and patients too. And, you know, one of the stories I tell about how it was found out that fat could actually communicate was through the story of the discovery of leptin. And so it started out with, in 1965 at Jackson Laboratory in Maine, which breeds mice models for research. And there was a researcher there named Doug Coleman, and he was tasked with examining two forms of very obese mice, one with a genetic defect called OB, another with a defect called DB. Both of them could not ever stop eating, and both of them had diabetes, but DB had a more severe form of that. And so Coleman had the idea to, he had a hunch that there was something in the blood of the DB mouse and causing this more intense form of diabetes. So we had an idea to exchange the blood of the two mice, right, connect them together so they would share the same blood supply. And he thought that OB would then start having this intense form of diabetes as well. But this was really the pivotal moment that changed everything, because when he did put the blood of DB into OB, the OB did not get a worse form of diabetes. Instead, what happened is OB stopped eating. It stopped eating altogether to the point that it actually starved to death, but there was no change in DB at all. And from that experiment, Coleman hypothesized that There's something in the blood of the CB mouse that is controlling appetite, and OB doesn't seem to have this thing. And he called this thing the missing factor. And he said, if you could discover what this missing factor was, it could be a cure for obesity. And he tried for years. He couldn't. He didn't have the right tools, Coleman. But then Jeffrey Friedman came into the research, and he's a molecular biologist. And really, for about 9 years, went on this quest to figure out what this missing factor was. And, finally, after these, 9 years, what he discovered, Friedman, was that fat is actually making a protein that he named leptin. And leptin means thin. It's from the Greek root leptos, meaning thin. And this hormone released by fat is going to the brain, and it's telling the brain to stop eating. And so OB didn't actually have this missing factor, this genetic defect. It didn't have this missing factor. And so its brain never got a signal to stop eating. DB had this missing factor, except DB couldn't respond to it. It had a defect in its brain that stopped it from responding. So it had plenty of this. And that's why when the two mice were connected, OB finally got this missing factor and it responded by not eating at all. And so people are the same way. People's fat also makes leptin, and leptin goes to our brain, our hypothalamus region, and it signals to us that we're all good now. We can stop eating. We have fat. It's there. In a way, it's inventory control of fat because it's a signal that fat is there and we don't have to eat in huge amounts. And there are people, the whole time Jeffrey Friedman is doing this research, there's a girl I write about in Britain who actually has a defect like the OB mouse. Her fat doesn't make leptin. And even as a child, she just gorged herself. I mean, she got to where she was about 8 years old and around 200 pounds. And everyone just thought she was headed for an early death from complications of obesity. But finally, when Friedman discovered this, she was able to get some injections of leptin, and her appetite diminished within days. And she's gone on to have a perfectly normal, healthy life thanks to the discovery of leptin. But that was the signal that shows fat, really, it's not just fat. That was one of the first studies that showed that fat can actually talk. It talks through leptin. It can signal to our brain. It can tell it to stop eating. And it turns out leptin is important for all kinds of things. It signals to our muscles. When we have more leptin, our metabolism is quite high. It signals to our thyroid gland. It signals to our reproductive system. Fat through leptin has wide-ranging effects in our body.
And that leads to the next chapter in the book, which is titled Your Life Depends on Fat. Who knew? How does it depend on fat?
Yeah, that's really great, isn't it? So fat is needed to keep us healthy. And so you have to have a certain amount of fat to function normally. In fact, people with anorexia nervosa have very low levels of fat. Like for all kinds of reasons, they have abnormal body functions. But a big part of it is just incredibly low fat levels. So fat is needed for our reproductive systems, and actually, women in particular, their reproductive abilities are linked to fat. So when women get to very low fat levels, say below 20%, their menstrual cycles are impaired. And in fact, if they haven't started menstruating yet, if they're girls and they haven't started yet, it'll be delayed if fat is too low. And we see this with ballerinas and with athletes. They actually have a problem. They can't start puberty in a way until they have enough fat. And, as they get older, here in Southern California, there's certainly a lot of eating disorders. And when I talk to reproductive specialists here, that's a real issue because when women don't have enough fat, they aren't menstruating properly. Their cycles are off. And these doctors try to get women to normal amounts of fat. Fat's also used as a source of energy for lactation. So once women do have kids, fat is important again. Fat is linked to brain size. This is a whole other dimension of it. When we have defective fat that doesn't make leptin, or again, insufficient fat, like people with anorexia nervosa, our brain volume is affected. We have loss of brain volume with insufficient fat. Bones and our immune systems have receptors for leptin, and so T cells, the activity of them is affected by leptin. Just so many things, even wound healing, right? We heal faster with normal amounts of fat. And again, people with anorexia nervosa take longer to heal in their wounds because it affects their veins. So, oddly enough, this thing that we despise, things that we want to get rid of at all costs, is fat. It turns out it's a critical organ. It's not just sitting there. It's affecting our veins, our immune system, our brains, our reproductive systems. It has profound effects in our bodies.
You end the chapter with a section that asks the question about what you term the obesity paradox. Can fat help us live longer? Can it help us live longer?
Well, what's interesting is that sometimes we're in a traumatic you know, situation, like a heart attack. You know, there's been some kind of trauma to our bodies where we're at the death doorstep. There's some studies that actually show that people who are overweight do better than people who are normal or underweight. It's like this U-shaped curve, oddly. And so there's something called the obesity paradox, where for all these diseases, fat is thought to cause, like diabetes and heart disease. Oddly, when you're really, you know, very sick from these things, the people who have a little bit more fat do better. They have a lower risk of death from those same diseases. And, you know, it's clear why it's called the obesity paradox, because it's very odd. It's fat, you know, is known to cause some of these problems, and yet people who are heavier seem to live longer. And I think there was just a paper recently in JAMA where they talked about dementia, and somehow people who were overweight, even some who were obese, had lower incidence of dementia. And that's conflicted. I've seen papers go either way. But I think it is, we're learning more that fat's not everything we think it is. I mean, certainly, you know, morbid obesity has a lot of problems, and it's something we shouldn't have. And I'm not promoting that at all. But I think what my research and my book is showing is that there's just so much more to it, and there's unanswered questions. And it's worth taking a fresh look at fat and not just being prejudiced and disdainful of it. It does have some vital functions in our body, and it is behaving in odd ways that's worth another look.
You talked at the beginning of our conversation about good fat and bad fat, and you have a chapter here that talks about good fat going bad. What happens when good fat goes bad?
Yeah, so for all these wonders and terrific things I've just said about fat, how it's, you know, having these beneficial effects in our body, not all fat is created equal. So there's subcutaneous fat, and that's the fat that's right under our skin. So in our thighs and our hips, you know, our abdomen, arms, and that is a safer deposit of fat. So if you're going to get fat, that's the place to put it. But then there's also visceral fat, which is that fat right under the stomach wall, and that's nestled against our internal organs. And that's the fat that can become inflamed when those fat cells get very crowded. So when we have too much visceral fat, it gets inflamed, and that inflammation interferes with insulin signaling. And so that is the kind of fat that is correlated with diabetes, and it's correlated with heart disease more so than subcutaneous fat. And so, you know, when you want to lose fat, you know, it's best to not be too heavy, but if you are going to be heavy, best to keep it in your subcutaneous areas and away from your visceral section. I do tell the story of sumo wrestlers, you know, the case study of sumo wrestlers.
Yes,
were,
that
you know,
was an interesting
obese
section.
Yeah, and they're obviously very obese, and you know, yet when they look at their metabolic profile, they're not unhealthy. And what they find is that sumo wrestlers don't have a lot of visceral fat. All that fat you see is in the subcutaneous layer. And interestingly enough, you know, fat has another trick up its sleeve here, is that it releases another hormone called adiponectin. And adiponectin actually guides fat in the blood out of the bloodstream and into subcutaneous fat where it belongs. Exercise promotes the release of adiponectin, and sumo wrestlers exercise 6 to 7 hours a day. They exercise all day. And amazingly, this seems to keep them healthy. It keeps fat going into subcutaneous fat, so that their circulating fat goes into subcutaneous fat, and it keeps their visceral fat low. And now when sumo wrestlers retire and they come off that exercise regime, they quickly get metabolically unhealthy. And so in a way, fat's trying to protect us. It's saying, you know, throwing all that fat in the blood to please come home, come to subcutaneous fat, keep this person healthy, get out of the way. Don't deposit in the liver, don't deposit in the heart, come to subcutaneous fat. And so, you know, just another sign that, you know, there's leptin. That's another one way fat talks, but fat can talk through adiponectin too and signal to that fat in the blood to come to subcutaneous fat and keep us healthy.
The final chapter in the first section of your book, and then we'll take a pause here, is about how fat fights to stay on you. What's that all about?
Yeah, that is really enlightening. So fat, because fat is important in our bodies, you know, we might not value fat, but our bodies do. And because it's important, it's endowed with all kinds of ways to fight our efforts to lose it. So we talked about leptin and the control that leptin has on appetite. And when we're at normal weight, we have pretty good leptin and we're overall satiated. When we lose fat, we actually lose leptin. And so we're leptin deficient in a way. And what that does is it makes our appetites go right through the roof. We get really hungry. We seek food much more. But it also decreases our metabolism. So our muscles bind leptin, and so does our thyroid gland. And when our leptin levels are lower, our metabolism goes down. And we actually, you know, I think it's about 15% decrease in metabolism at a state of rest, and about 25% higher efficiency of our muscles when we're exercising. So we use a lot less energy. And so that becomes a kind of recipe to regain weight because you're hungrier. You're seeking food a lot more. At the same time, your metabolism is lower. So whatever you do eat, it has more chance of going into your fat and having that fat come back. And it's actually really critical for people to know this because once you've reduced your weight, you're not really the same anymore. So say someone was 170 pounds and they lost 20 pounds to get to 150 pounds. That person will have to eat about 22% fewer calories because of the impact to their metabolism compared to someone who's at 150 pounds naturally without having to diet. They've just maintained that 150 pounds. And so there's a caloric penalty, if you will, to losing some fat. And when it's studied, it seems to last for, you know, up to 6 years. In fact, I'm not sure if it really goes away for everybody, that decrease in metabolism. And so I know a lot of people who think that's so depressing to have to hear that news. But for me, it was actually very empowering because it finally explained why I have to eat less than everybody around me to stay thin. Before that, I always felt like I'm failing on a diet. I'm doing something wrong. I'm not on the right diet. But having that insight, that scientific insight, you know, was finally the aha moment of this is why I am the way I am. And now I just work with it. It's like, yes, I eat less, but, you know, I've learned to live with it. And I've managed to keep my weight down just by having that knowledge. And it's a case of where knowledge is really power.
Yeah, there's a concept that you talk about throughout the book called a set point. Maybe we can finish our first conversation section here talking about that. That what is a set point when it comes to body weight?
It becomes established over time, but it's kind of where you are with your weight, and your body just tries to stay at that weight. So just like I talked about, when we lose weight, our body tries to come back to that weight by lowering metabolism, having us eat more. You know, even if you gain weight for a while, at least your body will try to stay at the original weight. It actually can be quite hard to gain weight because of the set point concept. And, you know, the effect can last for really quite a long time. But eventually, I think you do get to new set points with time. As your body adjusts to things going on, it will adapt over time. But it can really take years to make that change. And that's why when people are considering a diet, you have to know that this isn't something you just do for a few months and just get back to your life. Once you really lose fat or change your weight, you know, in either direction, you're going to have to make that change to your eating and your exercise really for years at a time. And, you know, it might be that it's a permanent change you have to make. So it really is a lifestyle and behavioral change that you're making for the long haul. And it's why it's important to find a diet that works for you for years, not just for months. And there's so many fad diets out there. There's always something new. There's, you know, eat the soup, or there's this pasta diet, or this, like, lose belly fat with some whole wheat bread you're supposed to buy from somebody. That can go on for a long time. There's always a new fad. And just be careful, because whatever you pick, you know, you got to pick something that works for you for the long run, for your, you know, biologically works for you, losing weight on it, but also, you know, socially it works for you. You can stay on this for years without getting tired of it. And so, you know, again, think of it as empowering. It's not depressing news. It's just that now you know it, you can face the facts, and you can figure out what to do and which diet you want to be on.
You're listening to a special here on Health Action about the secret life of fat. We're speaking with author Sylvia Tara, book of the same title. The subtitle is The Science Behind the Body's Least Understood Organ and What It Means for You. Take a break here for a couple of minutes, and we'll be back continuing our interview with Sylvia in a moment.
You're tuned to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
And we're back with the Health Action Special here. We're taking a look at the new book just out, The Secret Life of Fat, The Science Behind the Body's Least Understood Organ and What It Means for You. I'm Mark Hannay, co-host of the program. We're speaking with the author Sylvia Tarr of the book, who has a PhD in biochemistry from the University of California at San Diego and an MBA from the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. In the first part of the interview, we took a look at the first section of the book, which was all about fat. In the section of the book, it's called "It's Not Only Food That Makes Us Fat." And here we begin to look, you begin to look in the book, Sylvia, about external factors that come into play beyond just sort of our internal biology. The first chapter in here deals with bacteria and viruses. How are they related to how fat functions in our body, our weight, potential obesity, or anorexia, and so forth?
Yeah, so I think this is always surprising to people that bacteria and viruses have any role in fat at all. But really, you know, as far as viruses, it's been known about for a while in animals that viruses can cause fatness. So it was canine distemper virus was discovered to cause fatness in mice back in the 80s. Rouse-associated virus causes it in chickens. But when people hear this can happen in humans, they get quite skeptical. Although studies now show that there is a virus called AD36, and it is associated with fatness in humans. In fact, people who've had this virus tend to have double the risk of obesity compared to people who haven't. And the way this virus works is that it actually causes our cells to absorb more glucose from the blood. And so it's almost like insulin. We're just absorbing more of the nutrients, from our blood. And we create more fat molecules. And then we also create more fat cells. So the fat cells we have are getting bigger because we're creating more fat molecules, and we are creating more fat cells. The stem cells we have that can turn into muscle or bone or fat will actually turn into fat more. And so people, you don't have to be obese if you have this, but it does have a propensity to make people, I think, a little hungry. You're a little bit more predisposed to getting fat. And all the while, the scientists are studying this, and I give this very interesting story of Nikhil Durander, who is one of the people discovering AD36 and its correlation to fatness, and it took him years. But all the while he's studying this, I also tell the story of a patient named Randy who really struggled with his weight. And he finally finds himself at University of Wisconsin, where Nikhil Durander is, and they decide to test him for AD36, and he finds out he's positive for having carried this virus. And he thinks he got it from being scratched, by a rooster on his farm. This is when he correlates that all these things, happened. He started having more trouble with his weight, even though his family was thin. And, it's not completely verified that's the transmissibility, but that's in his mind where he connects it. But just having that knowledge that he gained from this program, the program talked about set points and leptin and what fat really is and how viruses are actually correlated with obesity, he becomes very empowered to fight off his fat. He feels like in the aha moment, like, so I finally understand my fat. I know what's going on. I know having this virus, having carried it, has really affected, my ability to gain weight. And he just gets really, again, it's an example of knowledge is power. He becomes very just motivated to fight it off. And I think he's, that now he's a 62. I think he's 6'1" or so. And he's gotten in great shape now. He's about 170 pounds. And so there are, other things that are not completely in our control that might not even be aware of. But if you notice that, you're not eating huge amounts of food, yet you seem to be getting fatter, there's all kinds of things that can be factoring in. Fat is not just sloth and gluttony, which is what everyone thinks it is. There could be viruses affecting it in our bacteria that we have in our gut that will affect how much fat you have too. Gender is a big component of fatness. Women certainly have a higher predisposition for fat than men. Our hormones will play a part. As we get older, our fat-busting hormones like testosterone, growth hormone, they really decline with age. And so it becomes much easier to gain weight with age. And so all of this really, in genetics, that's another one that I should bring up.
Yes, let's get into that. That's your next chapter in this section is about the role of genes in obesity. What role do genes play?
Yeah, so genetics plays a pretty big role in the amount of fatness we get. And so there's even certain populations where they are thought to have a thrifty genotype. So I do write about one population, which is the Pima Indians, and it's pretty well documented. But the Pima Indians migrated into the, what is now the United States and Mexico 30,000 years ago. And they were largely hunter-gatherers, and they sustained themselves. They had pretty active lives. But, they did experience famine several times a century. And the thought is that they developed this kind of thrifty genotype, which is a set of genes that really helps them sustain in times of famine. So they will store fat easier. and it's always padding for them to have it, and they're very efficient as far as their energy needs. They don't, their bodies are just lower metabolism. They don't use a lot of energy, and this all worked fine. It was fine to be like this for many, many years. But as Westerners came into into the regions where they settled, which was Arizona, they started adopting more Western type of living. So they went to work for factories. They didn't hunt anymore. They didn't have their own farms anymore. And they started eating Western foods, and they started gaining enormous amounts of weight, 3 times higher obesity rate compared to Caucasians in the same area, but largely the same lifestyle. And they compared this population to another group of Pimas that lived in Mexico that pretty much maintained the rural lifestyle they had. So they still hunted, they still farmed, and there was no real cars. They biked instead for transportation, and they were much, much thinner than the Arizona Pima. I think the Arizona Pima had about 10 times the obesity rate, the men did, of the Pima in Mexico. And so it's an illustration of how, the genes we have, they are going to affect us all differently. So some people might be able to eat that big pile of Western food for dinner. Other people are going to have a different reaction to it depending on their lineage. And there's other examples I give of specific genes that have now been identified that are correlated with fatness. One is called FTO gene, a variant of the FTO gene. Actually affects appetite. It makes people want more energy-rich foods. It also has more creation of white fat cells. People have a higher fatness level if they have the variant of the FTO gene. Another one called IRS1, similarly, people have more fatness with a certain variant of that gene. So this is really maybe one of the biggest areas, I think that'll be opened up as people research obesity more. But we are all really individual when it comes to our ability to lose weight and gain weight. And certainly twin studies support this too. When they look at how identical twins gain and lose, twins tend to be more correlated. So they tend to gain at the same rates, and they tend to lose at the same rates compared to other sets of twins that are not related. And I think there's even some studies where they take separated twins, twins separated at birth, and they find the fatness is more correlated genetically than it is correlated, with the family they live in. So there's more of a nature rather than nurture component to some of this fatness. So it's all very interesting. And it doesn't mean you have to be obese. It just means it might be harder for you. You might have more of a drive for certain types of food. You might be accumulating fat a little bit easier. You will have to work harder at it, controlling your food intake and exercise. One of the research said that when you get into like 6 times your resting metabolism on an exercise, it seems to blow away genetics. It doesn't matter at that point what your genetics, are predisposing you to. That seems to bust away fat. So being very smart about, what to do about your fat, understanding the research, which I try to make simple in the book, and this is putting more effort in it, you still can control your fatness level.
You have a whole chapter about gender differences, particularly women versus men. And you mentioned a few moments ago about how women are more prone to have more body fat. Briefly, what's that all about? Is it something to do with the 2X chromosomes or something else?
Yes, it has something to do with our chromosomes. I know this is something that has rattled women, I think, world over, noticing how much more men can eat compared to us. And I don't think there's a woman around who hasn't been totally frustrated by this. And so, it's true. Science shows that women are right in this observation, as usual. And even when they're babies, girls and boys, the fatness level is different. Girl babies, and this is some research I write about too, that they are seen to have a higher fat level even at birth or a few months after. And they think this is probably something that happens even before we're born. We just have more fat. And there's a whole bunch of reasons for that. And there are some people who study exactly this, out in the world. And as I talk to them, what I learn is that women actually partition nutrients slightly differently. So we put more of our food intake, all those nutrients, we partition more to fat than men do. So, and just to use an example, say we eat about 100 calories. Women might put 30 calories or so into our fat. It goes right into fat. And then, men will probably put 20, 15 or so. They'll just put less of it into fat. And so there's that partitioning of nutrients we get where women preferentially put more of it into fat. But not only that, women also utilize our fat differently. So our body fat, we utilize it differently. When we're at a time of real need, we're at a calorie or energy deficit, women's body will reach for fat more in that time of need compared to men. Men will actually reach more for glycogen, a carbohydrate store of energy, or protein. And so, you know, you would think this is a great thing. We're reaching for fat. We're using our fat more. But, you know, the issue is when we're done with that state, so say it's after our, you know, an overnight fast where we're energy deficient or after we do a lot of exercise, we'll reach for fat. But once we're past that stage and we eat or we break the fast, we actually start to store fat away into our fat tissue at 2 to 3 times a higher rate than men do. So our bodies are very efficient with fat. We use it, but we store it much more effectively as well. And that seems like, you know, a real curse. But the thing to know is that it's also keeping women's bodies a little bit healthier. Women have a little bit lower metabolic disease compared to men. It's because our bodies will take our fat circulating in our blood out of our blood and put it in the subcutaneous fat tissue where it belongs. So we have lower visceral fat, lower circulating fats, you know, in our blood, but just more fat in subcutaneous fat tissue. So, you know, a little bit of a benefit. You can use that to soothe yourself a little bit, you know, the woman, that there's reasons for us to have a little bit more fat. You know, just very interesting things. And women also respond to exercise differently. We're actually designed to put calories back in. So when we exercise, say like a pretty heavy-duty exercise session where we burn off 600 calories or so, compared to men, our ghrelin levels are higher. So ghrelin is a hunger hormone that comes from the stomach, and it certainly makes us hungry. And so we'll have a bigger response, have a higher ghrelin level after that exercise compared to men. And even after we eat, it persists at about a 25% higher level. So it's as if nature has designed us to be fat. We shuttle more into our fat. We store it away very efficiently and put nutrients back into fat. And we compensate a lot when we've used some fat or depleted some energy. Nature wants to make sure that women are putting that back on.
You're listening to a Health Action special here talking about the issue of fat. We're speaking with the author Sylvia Tara, who has written the new book out called The Secret Life of Fat, The Science Behind the Body's Least Understood Organ. We'll be back with our final section of the interview in a minute to talk about what are some of the solutions to controlling body fat. And welcome back to our Health Action special. We're taking a look at the issue of body fat. We're talking to Sylvia Tara, who's the author of the new book out, The Secret Life of Fat, The Science Behind the Body's Least Understood Organ and What It Means for You. I'm Mark Hannay, co-host of the program. In the final section of the book, it's about sort of what you can do about all of you've gained all this knowledge. You yourself have talked about your own experience and some patients who you document in the book, talking about actually being empowered by all this information. So the first chapter in this section is how you can do it, how you can control fat. So what are some of the basic ideas here that people, again, we don't have a lot of time to go into things in depth, but sort of what are the top line things people who want to control their body fat can and should be doing?
So I think the most important thing to know is there's not really one diet that fits everybody. My whole, you know, section in the middle there is about how, you know, people are individual. So your genetics will factor in. The bacteria you've harvested are going to factor in, as will your age, level of hormones, and gender, of course. And so some diet that works for a 22-year-old active male next door might not work the same for a 50-year-old woman who's had a couple of kids. It's going to be very, very different. And I think this is one disservice the diet industry can do, is that it puts out these diets, and they're supposed to be super easy to follow. And if they're not working for you, you're just doing something wrong. But, you know, the onus is on you. And I just think that's bad for people. It creates a guilt complex that makes them feel like they're failing. And people, you know, they tend to give up, or they just keep seeking one diet after another. So hopefully what all this knowledge does is it helps people individualize a diet that works for them. You know, another thing to know is that we don't all respond to food the same. And again, genetics factor in, hormones factor in. And there's some very good research done now where they show that people don't all have the same blood sugar response from food. So some people can eat sugar, and they like, you know, chocolate or ice cream or alcohol, and they don't really have a big blood sugar spike from that. There are other people who can't do that. The smallest thing, they'll have a reaction. They'll get that blood sugar spike. And so you have to kind of tailor a diet to what your body type is. And so, you know, also think about, you know, diet's not just, it's not just food. So there's a lot of diets that, yes, I will lose weight if I go on that diet. But the problem is I'm not going to stay at that diet long because it's just untenable for me. And I know, you know, an example of that, like ketogenic diets are very big right now. You know, they're incredibly restrictive. I find that I don't stay on them that long. For other people, they work great. So I'd say when you do pick a diet, pick one that is having an effect biologically. You are losing weight for your body type, but also one that you can stay on for years. Because as I said, it's not, you know, it's a very long-term effect when you lose weight. Your body has changed, your metabolism is a little lower. You'll have to stay on that diet really for years. So it has to work for you socially, something that you can, you know, be on when you're with your family or be on with guests, something that's going to work all around. And so, you know, I think what works really well is you try to eat for your hormones. I do talk about growth hormone in there. Insulin is a very big one that's talked about in dozens of books. And I do talk about insulin as well. But in addition to that, growth hormone and testosterone or other fat-burning hormones that you can manage with, you know, the way you eat. So, you know, another thing that I've adopted at least is intermittent fasting, where you extend that overnight fast a little bit. So I'll eat a very early dinner, 3:30 or so. And I won't eat again until, you know, 9 o'clock the next day. And so our growth hormone peaks at night. And when you extend that overnight fast, it's actually thought to prolong the release of growth hormone. And it's been a great fat busting thing for me. So think about your hormones. There are certain exercises that increase growth hormone and testosterone as well, and that will help you bust through fat. But I think more importantly than anything is try to, you know, for yourself, analyze what's working and what's not. And I know what I did in the end is I had the spreadsheet. And again, you know, I'm quite analytical, so it wasn't hard for me to do this, but it actually can be done by anyone. But just logging what I ate and when I ate it and what was the overall caloric intake and nutrient intake, it helped me start to hone what was helping me lose weight and what was making me gain weight. So I noticed, you know, just like that research I talked about, there were certain things I could eat and I wouldn't gain any weight. I can eat small amounts of chocolate and nothing seems to happen to me. And I'm not supposed to be able to do that. Any diet book will tell you, not, you know, don't do that. Yet it wasn't affecting me. But the other thing is I couldn't eat later in the night. So eating at 6 or after, I'd gain weight. And that was night after night, I would notice something like that. And so eating earlier is actually when I noticed I'm starting to lose weight. And that's how I came upon intermittent fasting for my own type of plan. So I guess, you know, the real takeaway is individualize your diet. And I'm hoping all the knowledge conveyed in this book helps people do that, helps them understand their own body type and why a diet may or may not be working for them. You know, the hard fact is if you've yo-yo dieted in the past or you have any of these issues that cause fatness like genetics or just, you know, age, if your hormones are declining, you will have to work a little harder at it than some other people. And, you know, it doesn't have to be depressing to hear that. Think of that as empowering because now you know what the issue is and you know what to do about it. And you can choose, you know, to do it or not, but you're at least tooled with that information. And there's one research I put in there where there's this, it was at Berkeley National Labs. This researcher studied male runners, and he noticed that every year they would gain weight. No matter what amount of weekly running they were doing, they tended to gain weight with time. And he finally concluded from all this research that these people had to add 1.4 miles to their weekly run for every year if they wanted to stay, you know, stay thin, stay at the same level. So say if someone was 30 years old running 10 miles a week, by the time they were 40, they had to be running 24 miles a week. They had to add 1.4 each year if they wanted to fit the same clothes as before. So that's just, you know, it's another example of, you know, depending on our body, where we are, our stage of life, we just have to work harder at it. The other thing that I hope people take away from this book is that having a little bit of extra fat isn't the end. You don't have to be, you know, like the bikini model or swimsuit model or athlete on the cover of a magazine. That's almost, you know, becomes a very hard goal. I don't want to say unachievable because it's not, but it's a very challenging goal to have as you get through life. And, you know, some fat is fine. And as long as it's stored away from your visceral section, into other parts, don't make goals that are just almost unattainable for yourself. It'll make you nothing but unhappy. And then I also have a chapter on the psychology of losing weight, yes, how to get your mind mentally tuned for that.
And you also talk about the importance of, you mentioned exercise, but also sleep.
Oh, sleep, yes. Yeah, so sleep, you know, for a number of things. So like our leptin levels, which again is tied to satiation, our leptin levels tend to be higher when we get adequate sleep. Ghrelin, which is the hunger hormone, actually escalates with insufficient sleep. So we get hungrier if we're not sleeping enough. And so, you know, growth hormone, you know, it peaks at night. It peaks during the sleep cycle. So that's a fat-busting hormone. And at the same time, leptin will be higher. That's a satiating hormone. And ghrelin will be lower, the hunger hormone. So there's nothing bad at all to say about sleep. You know, try to get your sleep. It'll just make all of this a little bit easier as you try, you know, go on the challenge of losing weight.
And lastly, in our minute or so, this is a book about research and what we've learned in recent decades about fat. Where's the future of the study of fat headed?
Yeah, that is so great. And so fat could have all kinds of uses for us, really. I mean, one thing is that we're finding stem cells in fat, so adipose-derived stem cells. And this has actually been used in medicine now, so it used to be from bone marrow, we would take out stem cells and use it. But of course, getting it from fat is much easier. And you know, it's been used to look at healing wounds faster, healing fractures faster, fractures of bone. I think Rick Perry, the governor of Texas, who's now, I guess, the head of energy, used it in his back after a back injury and had some great results using the fat-derived stem cells in his back. So, you know, it could be that all these tissue that we've hated for years and tried to get rid of might actually become some kind of magical potion for healing. It's even being used for wrinkles now and to look more youthful. So there could be all kinds of uses for fat. And that's, you know, almost on a little bit of a, you know, fringe kind of sideline there. But, you know, as far as fat management, what lies out in the future that I think could be promising is, leptin injections might be promising here. And so, yeah, as I said, when we lose fat, we lose some leptin. We almost become like a leptin deficient state. And it makes your appetite high. It makes your metabolism low. And this isn't available yet, but I know it's being studied that people, when they have lost 10% of the weight and they get leptin injections, they're actually able to maintain that weight loss a little easier. They're not as hungry. Their metabolism goes up too. And so that could be quite promising. Injecting brown fat into white fat. So brown fat, it actually burns energy. It's a different kind of fat in our bodies. It's around our heart area and our spine. And I'm trying to convert white fat to brown, which can be done through cold exposure, sometimes exercise. That's being looked at as another way to perhaps change the composition of fat. So a lot of things, you know, in the future. And I think, too, the treatment of fat and overweight, I'm hoping that will change, too. Right now it's still you get a diagnosis, you're overweight, or, you know, your doctor tells you, you know, lose some pounds and come back and see me. And that's really hard to do. And the really successful obesity clinics or diabetes clinics that I've spoken to, they really meet with patients ongoing, almost weekly in the beginning, to make sure they're getting on a plan, make sure it's working. And there's something about having that authority figure checking on a patient that really seems to work. And they'll coach a patient back on when they come off. And, you know, just like we don't tell diabetics to, you know, hey, stop having sugar and come back and see me. At the same time, I think we have to change the treatment of people who've gotten overweight. It is really, really hard to lose it. It's really hard to maintain weight loss. And I don't think it can be quite so hands-off. And, you know, preventing a lot of weight gain is going to be much more beneficial to us as a society, you know, compared to trying to lose it later, because fat does devise all kinds of tricks to stay on you once you have it. And you know, I used to study cancer, and I think it's not that different, because cancer has ways of diverting blood supply to itself to help it grow. It kind of changes your body to make it survive, and fat's a little bit the same way. So once we have it, it doesn't want to come off. And so more around the prevention of a lot of weight gain. Right now you have to be, you know, I don't know how heavy, morbidly obese before you can really qualify for gastric bypass surgery or any other tool, or even like weight loss drugs. And, you know, I'm hoping that turns around to where you have more effort put on prevention rather than let's deal with it after it's already happened, after all the fat accumulation has happened. So, you know, a lot of things, a lot of directions we can take from here.
Great. Well, thank you very much. It's been a fascinating interview. It was a very interesting read for me as a book. We've been speaking with Sylvia Tarr, who's the author of the new book, The Secret Life of Fat: The Science Behind the Body's Least Understood Organ and What It Means for You. Thanks so much for joining us on Health Action, Sylvia.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
And that'll do it for this Health Action special. I'm Mark Hannay. Thanks to Catherine Davis for engineering the program. We'll catch you back here next week.
Every year at this time, the National Space Administration requires all aliens to register. Forms are available at your local post office. Those without forms must appear, however briefly, at the Bureau's astral offices on Nooker Street. Aliens, register now.
Morning. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. This is a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. And this 1 a.m. now is our new time slot for the nonce. We'll be here till 3. Our guest is Richard Bowes. You will enjoy, I promise.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. If Jordan Peele's new film, Get Out, was merely the racial Stepford Wives the trailer implied it would be, that would certainly be enough. Peele is best known for his work with Keegan-Michael Key on the comedy sketch show Key and Peele, and that show was notable for its cinematic ambition, satirizing genres through a wholehearted embrace of those genres, to the extent where the dividing line between the real thing and the takeoff became almost indistinguishable. In telling the tale of a young, creative African-American photographer, played by Daniel Kaluuya, accompanied by his white girlfriend, played by Allison Williams, home to visit her parents, Catherine Keener and Bradley Whitford, and discovering that the Black House staff is behaving very oddly, Peele plays it straight in deploying all the tools of the horror film. Since this is a Blumhouse production that includes the incorporation of a video screen and the obligatory moment when something emerges from the periphery of the frame that the main character is not aware of, and Peele's confident command of the genre, leavened by disturbing performances by Marcus Henderson, Betty Gabriel, and Lakeith Stanfield, make this a truly gripping nightmare with lashings of well-placed humor. It's essentially what was done on Key and Peele, but with the air quotes removed. Peele, though, to his credit, has decided to dig the needle a little deeper, hitting at questions of appropriation and identity that have long dogged the relationships between blacks and whites. One has to wonder if some of this wasn't inspired by Peele's time at Comedy Central. The network notably and prematurely lost Dave Chappelle when he began wondering whether perceptions of his sketch show were running counter to his intent. And Key and Peele voluntarily walked from their own show after 5 seasons. Although that likely was motivated as much by their growing success outside of the show, including the imminent production of Get Out. The revelation of what's actually going on in the largely lily-white suburb of the film raises uncomfortable issues of a kind of liberal racism that conceals white envy under a facade of admiration. That Get Out manages to do it while staying a wholly inventive and gripping foray into horror makes it this year's first genuine must-see. Get Out is rated R, which is weird because it isn't especially gory, which leads one to suspect that the MPAA is weighing in on issues of theme that it really shouldn't be bothering with. On the other hand, the new French film, Raw, fully earns its R rating. In fact, there have been reports of audience members fainting during fest screenings. And that's a little weird, maybe, because unless it's Sundance and can be blamed on the altitude, the film isn't really that gross. I'm suspecting that this tale of Justine, a veterinary student played by Garance Marier, transforming from a dedicated vegetarian to conflicted cannibal, is throwing people more for the whole mise-en-scène than the flat-out gushiness. Director Julia Ducournau revels in the blunt but artful rendition of student politics and studies in a veterinary school, with freshmen undergoing an especially visceral form of hazing by upper classmates in the off hours and being arm-deep up the anuses or vaginas, I wasn't sure which, of farm animals during class time. It could be that the cannibalism is meant to be an exploration of the blurry line medical practitioners must daily tread, or it could be about the strange bond Justine has with her sister, played by Ella Rumpf, who's 1 year ahead of her in the school. What there is that kind of offhanded candidness and visual beauty that is distinct to French horror. If you can handle raw shocks, its impact goes deep. And if you want to stay Gallic, but maybe more family-friendly, there is the Oscar-nominated stop-motion animated French film My Life as a Zucchini. Director Claude Barrès brings a tremendous amount of heart to this bittersweet tale of children winding up at an orphanage after suffering various abuses at the hands of their parents and guardians. And credit has to be given for the nuances given to each character, including a bully whose occasional brutishness masks his own damage. I do wonder if this drama was being played by live actors rather than Mr. Barris's eccentric, big-headed animation figures, whether the narrative would seem too pat. But as it is, My Life as a Zucchini is a great demonstration of animation's power to stir emotions. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
Thank you, Dan. And, isn't it thoughtful? Somebody actually supplied us with tissues so I could turn off my mic and sneeze. Aren't you pleased that I did not share that with you? There you go. There you go. So what you hear in the background because we don't have much in the way of soundproofing, is nothing less than the station manager working to have the income for WBAI tallied up. We would like to thank everybody who pledged during the most recent fund drive. It was actually rather successful, which does not, yeah, it does not surprise me for one simple reason: Voldemort, President Voldemort.
Yes.
Sorry.
Say what?
Sorry.
Yeah, right. I'm just saying that, you know, with the administration being what it is, BAI should horribly benefit from that. And we have done well, and we want to thank you, and therefore we will happily put up with background noise. But this is, let's see, so this is now 1 a.m. on Wednesday night, Thursday morning. Technically, it's Thursday morning, but if you're listening in California, which you may very well be because it's the internet, then it's, well, a little after 10 p.m., yes. So...
Late evening.
Yeah, yeah, late evening, primetime radio, actually, so yes. Yeah. So we're now in a primetime slot.
Right. Several thousand miles away, but nonetheless.
Well, yeah, but hey, but that
doesn't matter. No.
It doesn't matter anymore.
No, no,
it's all a village, you know. As we add internet to it, the electronic village.
Many things have changed.
Yeah, so this show, which has been on the air in one form or another since Margot Adler began it in 1972, has moved around a bit. We were in one time slot, God help us, for 39 years.
Yeah.
Well, when I say five, it's moved around from days. It used to be 5 days a week, then it went to Fridays, then to Thursdays, then to Saturdays, and that was its longest tenure, was for over 20 years. And then we were moved to Wednesday nights at 1:30, but shortened to 90 minutes. Now we're back to 2 hours, 1 a.m. And whenever I have a landmark show of this type, there are only two people who I would have on, and one of them is sadly deceased. That would be Margot Adler. And the other is Richard Bowes. So guess who's
not
with
deceased.
Us. Not deceased. Happily, very much with us. And so Hour of the Wolf is now in its 46th year on the air. We had our 45th anniversary in January. And I began, are you ready? I began at WBAI. I know the exact date. It was May 1st. 1967. So
a date that will live in infamy.
In May. This coming May will be my 50th anniversary working here.
Wow.
Can you imagine that?
No.
Yeah, neither can I. And I've actually lived it. I will have to tell the management. Bertholdt!
Yes.
You know that on May 1st? Is my 50th anniversary here?
Yes, I know.
Yeah, oh, because you just heard it, right? What are we going to do? I'm going to get a chocolate watch or something?
Have any of it downstairs?
Yeah, oh, well, maybe we should. It's a good day for fundraising. Okay. For those who don't know, that the manager actually does give his all.
Yes.
Yeah, he's here.